The next case is 03-1767, State of Ohio versus Andrea Marie Francis.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Bartel. I represent the appellant, Andrea Marie Francis. This morning, the sole issue to consider is when the trial court fails to give the required statutory advisement that's contained in Ohio Revised Code Section 2943.031 to a non-citizen regarding deportation, naturalization, or denial of admission into the United States. Does the trial court have the discretion to impose time limitations on a motion filed pursuant to that code section? Ohio Revised Code Section 2943.031 provides an independent basis to allow the defendant to withdraw a guilty plea or a plea of no contest. By enacting this statute, the General Assembly realized that immigration issues play an integral role in a non-citizen defendant's decision to enter a plea. Further, in crafting the language of the statute, the legislature had the foresight to realize that non-citizen defendants would not realize the potential pitfalls and entry of a guilty plea for many years to come after, in fact, entering that guilty plea.
You don't think that the trial judge effectively advised the appellant when he said, by entering a plea of guilty, this may affect your rights in this citizen, as a citizen in this country. You think the trial judge has to be more specific than that?
I do believe so, Your Honor. The revised code section specifically states that the court must address the issues of deportation, denial of naturalization, as well as the fact that the defendant could in fact become inadmissible when attempting to enter the United States. Further, this statute is different than any other statute contained in the Ohio Revised Code, in that it's encased in quotations, whereby the 8th District Court of Appeals has ruled in State of Ohio versus Coran that this enforces the court's obligation to, in fact, give a verbatim recitation of this subsection to the defendant when they are, in fact, entering a plea of no contest or, in fact, a plea of guilty to the charges before them. This revised code section reads in quotations, if you're not a citizen of the United States, you're hereby advised that a conviction of the offense to which you are pleading guilty may have the consequences of deportation, exclusion from admission to the United States, or denial of naturalization pursuant to the laws of the United States. Further, this statute states in subsection D that upon motion of the defendant, the court shall set aside the judgment and permit the defendant to withdraw the plea of guilty.
Counsel, how do you address the arguments of the prosecution that we routinely add timeliness requirements to several different statutes that the legislature passes, and to make an exception here requires them to, in perpetuity, keep any evidence of any crime committed by a non-resident alien? And that creates a tremendous burden, let alone all the staleness, the fact that witnesses died, that you could move 20 years later. Why should we treat this differently? What is the compelling reason that we give a non-resident this greater right to have evidence preserved forever that we don't give in many, many other statutory scenarios?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that to differentiate between this particular Ohio Revised Code statute and specifically speaking Ohio Criminal Rule 32.1, there's a clear difference in the language provided by the legislature for the courts to apply, in that in Ohio Criminal Rule 32.1, the legislature states that when the defendant is able to demonstrate that a manifest injustice has occurred, the court may allow the defendant to withdraw a plea of guilt. However, in this statute, it is very clear the legislature chose to use different terms and language in constructing the statute, that being when the defendant has been able to demonstrate the four requirements, that being that the advisement was required to be given, the advisement was not given, the defendant's not a citizen, and the defendant may in fact suffer these repercussions that we spoke of earlier, that the court shall set aside this verdict.
Is this a constitutional right that is enforced by statute, or is this just a statutorily given right?
I believe that it's a statutory right that was determined by the legislature.
Well, we've even imposed time limitations on the exercise of constitutional rights. Why not so in a statutorily given one?
Well, I also believe that when crafting the statute, Your Honor, that the legislature, in fact, had the foresight to determine that immigrants, we're talking legal permanent residents, would not know the repercussions of their guilty plea for many years to come. The way that the Immigration Service handles a great number of their cases is a plea of guilt may be given and an individual may be out for years and years before they realize the repercussions of their actions. As in the case of Ms. Francis, she entered her plea in 1992. She then applied for naturalization almost 10 years after that and was denied because of this plea. I believe it would be unfair for the courts to place on a defendant a vague issue or a vague element such as timeliness, because when does the timeliness issue, if this court were to in fact determine that timeliness is an element the court may consider, when does that begin to run? At the time of the plea, or does it begin at the time that the resident alien determines that they have in fact been prejudiced by their plea? In the case of Ms. Francis, she reacted almost instantaneously. Upon being denied naturalization, she then filed for her motion to vacate pursuant to the statutory rights that the Ohio legislature deemed appropriate for non-citizen residents of the United States. And I also believe that the legislature, in fact, determined that these rights were tantamount for a non-citizen when entering a plea of guilt, because the legislature realized that there's a potential problem for a non-citizen in that by entering a guilty plea, they won't be punished just once by the criminal justice system, but they could in fact be punished twice for their actions. And I believe the legislature had this in mind when they were attempting to offer this additional statutory protection to non-citizens of the state of Ohio. And I believe this issue has been argued in the 10th District in State of Ohio versus Ewan, whereby the 10th District determined that the trial court does not have the discretion to determine whether or not elements such as timeliness, additional elements that are not dictated in the statute, and they should mandate and vacate the guilty pleas and for prior cases.
Well, I guess if we have made this argument, but if we hold that trial courts from this day forward, or when we enter our opinion, are required, as the statute says they are required, to read to non-citizens the statutory language that the General Assembly has created, then everybody's on notice, are they not, that's the law. And so we don't have the problem that's been raised by the appellee that we have this gap in information or evidence or whatever, because prosecutors will be, in this case, I would think another answer would be that the prosecutor knew that the trial judge here did not give the charge or the information required under the statute, and that the prosecutor here perhaps should hold on to some evidence, because it's a clear violation of the statute. I mean, that's no way around it. And so does that make any sense to you, or only to me?
It does, but I do believe that the courts have been on notice that it is a requirement since this statute was put on the books. The courts have been advised and that they are required to give a non-citizen these advisements. I do believe that the key issue, and as raised by Justice Stratton in a previous question, the burden that's placed upon the prosecutor's offices statewide and having to maintain evidence in cases such as this is outweighed significantly by the additional ramifications that a non-citizen defendant could in fact face after entering a plea of guilt or no contest to criminal charges. And unfortunately today, a lot of the the cases that non-residents or non-citizens are facing deportation for are not necessarily cases whereby the defendant has exhibited convictions for felony ones and felony twos. Quite often these are cases for misdemeanors, as low as misdemeanors of the fourth degree.
Well, they could be felony ones or twos, though, couldn't they?
They very well could be, Your Honor. But I don't believe that that fact in and of itself should allow the, should take away the statutory right from the non-citizen defendants that the Ohio legislature deemed an appropriate remedy for them.
Counselor, why is this directive in the statute not satisfied by substantial compliance? What's your best argument to that in language of the, obviously, timeliness was the issue that the 8th District took a look at, but the prosecutor also addresses substantial compliance in the language that is contained in the record. It's a non-constitutional right, or issue, let's put it that way, addressed here, created by the statute for a certain class of people, which are people who are non-citizens, who get themselves into a criminal situation, and there are consequences. Why is substantial compliance not enough?
Well, first and foremost, as raised by the 8th District Court of Appeals in the State of Ohio versus Coron, this particular statute is unique in that it is encased in quotations. And our Court of Appeals in Cuyahoga County has determined that these quotations signify the legislature's intent that the court grant a verbatim recitation of this statute. Further, the particular dialogue that was engaged between the court and Ms. Francis, I believe, does not satisfy the substantial compliance requirement, even if this honorable court were to say that would be sufficient. I believe that just by saying you may be suffering immigration consequences by entering this plea does not go into the details of deportation, denial of naturalization, or in fact being deemed inadmissible when trying to re-enter the United States. Those are three very independent and very different penalties than a non-citizen would face at different times in their lives.
And they're unique to a non-citizen, correct?
Correct. And we would respectfully request that this court reverse and remand the issue that the 8th District Court of Appeals had determined that timeliness is an element that they may consider when a criminal defendant who is a non-citizen of the United States meets the four requirements that have been established in Ohio Revised Code Section 2943.031, further indicating that the court does not have discretion when denying or granting these motions when those four elements have been met due to the legislature's use of the term shall, whereby requiring the trial courts to, in fact, grant these motions if the four requirements are met. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bartel. Ms. Lucia.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kristen Lusney on behalf of the State of Ohio. Ohio Revised Code Section 2943.031 has been interpreted by the 8th and 10th District Courts of Appeals with inconsistent results. In the case before the court this morning, the 8th District determined that the 9-year delay between the defendant's filing of her motion to withdraw a guilty plea was a factor that militated against the granting of her motion. In a conflicting decision, the 10th District reviewed a similar case and concluded that the timeliness of the filing is not a factor that a trial court should consider when examining a 2943.031 motion to withdraw a guilty plea. I submit to the court that the rationale that was employed by the 8th District Court of Appeals is more persuasive in that it takes into account the intent of the legislature. And I respectfully request that this court affirm the 8th District's decision for the following reasons.
Well, here, Ms. Francis filed her motion to withdraw a guilty plea about a month after she was denied citizenship. Isn't that correct?
That is correct.
So she wasn't really dilatory unless unless you say she was dilatory and when she filed her application to become a citizen, but I don't think that's for us to decide. But she filed within a month after she was told you can't be a citizen because of this crime. And what's wrong with that? Why should we impose a strict time limit on somebody who's not been given the clear statutory information that the General Assembly has said she should be given before she makes her guilty plea?
I believe, Your Honor, that in this particular case, the timeliness should be calculated from the date the plea was entered and not from the date that she received notice that her application for naturalization had been denied. And the reason for that is because of the colloquy that did take place. In this particular case, the court at the time of her plea, first of all, stating that she was going to make sure the defendant was aware of all the rights that she was waiving, and she went on to ask, are you a citizen? The defendant said, no, but I am trying to become one. After offering that information, the court said, are you aware that by entering a plea of guilty to this felony today, your rights in this country could be affected?
Yeah, and the General Assembly, for some reason, we don't know why, but for some reason, made a rather extraordinary act in under point 031. And it just may be that because the General Assembly realized that somebody who's not a citizen of this country may have a little difficulty in understanding a general statement from a trial judge that, well, now you're going to give up some rights here now if you plead guilty. Isn't that precisely why the trial judge should not take a shortcut in a case? It's so clear to me that the General Assembly said, this is trial judge, this is what you have to do. Trial judge said, well, for some reason, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to give you some general statement about you're giving up your rights, and here she is. 8 years or whatever it was, 9 years later, she realizes that she's given up some rights that she didn't think she should have given up or whatever. I guess I'm having a difficult time understanding the Eighth District's rationale that when the statute is so clear that we try to say, well, maybe substantial compliance fits here. Why do we do that when the statute, the General Assembly, it's not for us to decide whether this is a good thing for trial judge to have to do, but there it is. The General Assembly sets the policy. And for trial court to just sort of, yeah, and I don't have enough time to read that to it. We've seen this, I guess the reason I'm reacting the way I am is because we've seen a few cases recently in which trial courts have done the same thing. It's very clear, a rule is clear, a statute's clear, and they don't follow it. And then they want us to sort of fix it for them. Why should we fix this for
Well, Your Honor, I think that in this case, first of all, we're talking about a non-constitutional right. And I think that because of that, substantial compliance is the appropriate standard that should be applied. Now, whether or not the better practice would be to read verbatim the advisement that is set forth in the statute, I think that it is important to note that in this case, enough information was given to this particular defendant.
How do we know that? How do we know enough information was given to her when she is a non-citizen? We can assume that she perhaps didn't know much about the legal system. I don't know what her language barrier is. Oftentimes, non-citizens have language barriers.
There was no interpreter involved in this particular case, and I would just direct the court's attention to looking at the plea transcript in its entirety. This is a defendant who demonstrated she was actively involved in the plea colloquy. She demonstrated an understanding of the proceedings. In at least two different locations throughout the transcript, she asked the court to repeat a question that she didn't understand. She, at another point, takes a moment to confer with her attorney about a particular point. And finally, before the actual plea is entered, the court invited the defendant to ask any further questions of the court or of her attorney, and the defendant declined that invitation. So I think when we look at the context here, I think that this particular defendant should be held accountable for waiting 9.5 years after the time that she entered her plea to finally file a motion to withdraw guilty plea under this particular statute.
Because she should have realized that day or sometime very soon after that what she had done, I guess. Is that your point?
She had enough information on that date that for a person who has the goal of citizenship, who says that on the record at the time of her plea, when the court says, do you understand that by pleading guilty to this felony today that your rights in this country could be affected? And she answers yes, and then further answers that she has discussed this problem with her attorney. I think we have enough information in this particular case to start counting the time as of the date of the plea, not as the date that this defendant was denied her application for naturalization.
Counsel, it's not so much that the language of the trial court is that your rights could be affected. In fact, he says it would affect your rights in this country with certainty, according to the statement of the case, your page one. Do you understand that if you enter a guilty plea to the felony, that it would affect your rights in this country? It's not even speculative. It's not a maybe. It's a definitive statement.
That actually goes beyond what the statute would require. The statute doesn't require a court to inform a defendant if they would, in fact, be deportable because of a particular conviction. They only have to notify them that deportation may be a consequence of a plea to any felony.
Never mind.
I'd like to get back to, for just a moment, if I could, some of the effects that just a very strict reading of the statute would have, and if timeliness is not applied. If timeliness is never a consideration in these types of motions, a non-citizen defendant would have carte blanche to file their motion to withdraw a guilty plea within a month, a year, or even 50 or more years after their plea is entered, and no matter what injustice would be caused to the state. This interpretation would require the state to preserve its evidence, to maintain its witness lists and contacts in perpetuity for every single case involving a non-citizen defendant. This is not only an unreasonable result, but it's also a very costly burden on the state, especially if you consider cases that may involve firearm storage or DNA preservation.
Would that be true if the trial court had given the statement, given her the statement that the statute says it should have given her?
If
would the timeliness be an issue? If the trial court here had read from the statute what the statute says the trial court should have read to it, is there a timeliness issue, or does that issue change if the trial court follows the law?
If the trial court follows the law, the defendant would never be entitled to withdraw their guilty plea, whether it was timely or untimely filed.
So isn't that the solution?
If a verbatim recitation is given in every single case, then certainly timeliness would never be a factor. However, I don't think that a verbatim recitation is what the legislature intended.
Well, they said it, but that's what they said. It said it shall be given.
But if we do not add the timeliness issue, you never know the answer to that question, whether the client didn't understand English, so he really didn't matter that you read it to him because you didn't have a translate. I mean, there could be a lot of peripheral issues that would still require the preservation of the evidence if we never require timeliness to apply.
Certainly evidence would be required to be preserved just as in any other case, but I think that with a guilty plea, the state should have a reasonable expectation of finality, just as a defendant does. I think that the state should be afforded the same, that after a certain period of time, finality can be expected in that particular plea. I think this is sort of alluded to also in subsection A of the statute that says, upon request of the defendant, the court shall allow him additional time to consider the appropriateness of the plea in light of the advisement. Requiring this period of reflection upon a defendant's request, I think it further indicates and suggests that once this plea is entered, finality should be expected by both the defendant and by the state. Another consequence in never applying a timeliness, never allowing a court discretion in reviewing these types of motions, would be that it actually would behoove a defendant to wait as long as possible after entering their plea before filing their motion, because they can benefit from the state's evidence having become stale, witnesses becoming unavailable, and potentially, in certain cases, if they wait long enough, a defendant could theoretically escape prosecution altogether. Also, as Justice Stratton mentioned earlier, if no time requirement is ever applied to these types of motions, then a non-citizen convicted felon would essentially be given more rights with respect to a non-constitutional issue than a citizen convicted felon is granted, even with respect to constitutional issues. Every method for seeking review and for seeking post-conviction relief that is available to a defendant has a timeliness standard that is applied, whether it's a direct appeal, a motion for new trial under Criminal Rule 33, a post-conviction petition under 2953.21, or a motion to withdraw a guilty plea under 32-1, all of these have time constraints that are applicable. And where a defendant makes an untimely filing under any of those rules or statutes, they require that the defendant must justify their delay. So even where there's an issue of constitutional proportions, like in a post-conviction petition, who perhaps a defendant is raising a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, but they're filing outside the time constraints of the statute, the defendant has to justify their untimely filing before the court can even consider that petition. So taking this into consideration, it's illogical to conclude that 2943.031 creates even greater rights for a non-citizen defendant with respect to an issue that is not even of constitutional magnitude. All of these different effects are unjust, and they could not have been within the intent of the legislature in enacting the statute. The intent, I think, behind this particular statute was simply to put these non-citizen defendants on notice that pleading guilty to a felony may have additional consequences that could be of particular interest to them, such as deportation, exclusion from admission, or denial of naturalization. The federal government and a number of other states have no codified deportation advisement that is comparable to Ohio's 2943.031. Rather, under federal law and in a number of states, deportation is viewed simply as a collateral consequence of a guilty plea that need not be explained to a defendant in order to ensure that their plea is knowing and voluntary. Even in Ohio, the deportation advisement is a statutorily conferred non-constitutional right, and timeliness is a procedural consideration that truly should be applied. Also, I'd like to submit to the court this morning that it is illogical to conclude, as the defendant in this case suggests, that the four requirements set forth in subsection D should be considered by the trial court to the exclusion of any other conceivable interest. In other words, not only should a trial court have the discretion to consider timeliness, but the court should also be able to consider other factors that may fall outside the particular requirements of subsection D that may be relevant to a given case. In Cuyahoga County, there's a case before the trial court right now where the defendant perhaps wasn't given a full advisement under the statute, but appears to meet the other three requirements of subsection D. However, a part of the record in that case, there's a notice of rejection from a pretrial diversion program. And that particular rejection was filed and is part of the record in that case. And it was served on the defendant, and it specifically states, defendant is in this country on a permit for application of residency, and admission of guilt would deport him. This entry was filed with the trial court and is certainly a factor that the court should be able to consider when weighing this defendant's motion, in which he claims that he had no idea that his conviction might, for that particular offense, might render him deportable. So to find that as the 10th District did in Ewan, that a trial court has absolutely no discretion when reviewing 2943.031 motions would not only be saying that a court cannot consider timeliness, but that a court cannot consider any other imaginable factor that might otherwise be relevant to the defendant's motion. As I mentioned briefly, I believe that the timeliness was properly applied by the 8th District in this case. I think that timeliness should be counted from the date of the defendant's plea based on the information that was exchanged between the court and the defendant. And I see that my time is just about up here, so I would like to conclude very briefly that the state of Ohio respectfully requests that this court affirm the decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals in the state of Ohio versus Andrea Francis. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Luznia. Mr. Bartel, you've saved about almost 2 minutes of your time.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. As Justice Moyer had indicated in his questioning to Ms. Luznia, the issue of timeliness would not be a factor if the trial court, in fact, had obliged the terms of the Ohio Revised Code and, in fact, had given the advisement as set forth by the Ohio legislature. Timeliness would never have been an issue. However, in the case that we have here this morning, we're dealing with a case where the trial court failed to meet the requirements as set forth by the Ohio Revised Code, and the court failed to properly advise Ms. Francis of the immigration repercussions that she would, in fact, and is, in fact, facing today due to her guilty plea. I do believe that by placing an additional burden upon the defendant in a case such as Ms. Francis is too much to overcome. in that it wasn't her fault or any non-citizen defendant's fault that the advisement was not properly given to them. They are not versed in the procedures and processes in the courtroom. They are merely there acting as defendants and generally following the procedure as given to them by their attorneys. And also, you know, the attorneys may have also limited knowledge in the exact immigration repercussions that guilty pleas in certain criminal acts would in fact have upon their clients. I do believe that when the court does fail to act as the legislature had requested them, in fact, by requiring them to read this statute and advise the defendant should not be overcome and overburdened with having a time requirement in filing a motion to vacate their guilty pleas when it is, in fact, the trial court that has failed to make this advisement as required by law. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.